All right, it's time for another episode of the Life 2.0 podcast. I'm John St. Augustine. I hope this finds you well wherever you're listening in the world. I appreciate the notes that I get. It's really fascinating on many levels to me, being in radio as long as I have and doing this whole podcast thing for a couple of years now. You never know who's listening, where they're listening, or even why they're listening. So first of all, thanks to the people that are subscribers to this this little adventure we go on 4 to 6 times a month. In the outdoor, up the down staircase, looking for the obvious, buried in the absurd, if at all possible. And they make it possible by plunking down a mere $20 a month, $5 a week. That's 66 cents a day for those of you who went to public school to keep this on the air and do what I do. Otherwise, I'd be doing something else. I mean, I do other things, but you know what? It's a nice pitch, don't you think? Anyway, great show today. I've been looking forward to this for 2 months. Gary Meyer. If you're a radio person, you know the name Gary Meyer. He's really a legend. He was voted in the Radio Hall of Fame back in 2013. He was number 32 out of the 100 most influential talk hosts in America in 2014. Recognized multiple years by Talkers Magazine. He's one of the top talk radio hosts in America. He's done it all. And it was actually the death of Brian Dennehy, a good friend of his who passed away a couple months ago, that prompted our conversation. So let's get to it. First of all, I appreciate you taking the time. This is
no problem.
Yeah, this to me is like, you know, you get a chance. We can air the shit out big time on podcasting. The stuff you could never do on terrestrial radio. And I've really come to appreciate it reluctantly. Like we talked briefly the other day, this is like I was kind of pulled kicking and screaming into this. I remember, you know, when you were kind of moved into the GN thing, and I don't know that you have much choice in that. But I think we talked once about a year later, and you said, you know, I wish I'd have done it earlier.
Yeah. It is something that is here. It's going to keep growing, and it will eventually eclipse terrestrial radio. Not next week, not next month, but it's here to stay. And it's the same concept as appointment television. It's appointment so-called radio. Yeah. And the flexibility of it is what's going to be key. And people wrote off podcasts 8, 9 years ago. Well, it's a bunch of losers in their basement. And there are those. There are 800,000 podcasts. I get that. But it's not being dismissed anymore.
Right. You know, it's the thing to me is that it's like the double-edged sword, right? So on one hand, it's great to have this accessibility and anybody with a phone can become a podcaster. But I also found out about a week ago, I don't know what the source was. I'd have to go back and look. That the average podcast lasts about 6 episodes, and people hang it up.
Yeah, well, that's good. There are a lot of hobbyists, and I've been to a couple of these podcast conventions, and it's almost like Amway, I have to say. And you could tell 95% of these people are just doing it because they could have never gotten on radio, right. And now they think this is their chance, or they're just doing it for a lark. Unfortunately, they're in the pool with everybody else, so that brings it up to 800,000 podcasts.
Right.
What are you going to do? It's just going to be the survival of the fittest, and the cream, as they say, rises to the top, all those cliches. But it's here. This is it. It's not going away. It's not a fad. And I know when I interviewed Howard Stern at the start of my podcast, he pretty much had written podcasts off. He told me that on the interview. And then I think as the years went by, he realized that it isn't going away.
Right.
And maybe he did it to dismiss it because it's going to compete with satellite. And you don't like to see a competitor ever. And you tend to dismiss it if you can. But I think initially he was reluctant to even think this was going to be a thing. But he changed his tune as as the years went on.
Yeah, I was totally wrong about XM Sirius. My move from terrestrial radio when I was in Michigan, I was brought on to head up some of the work at the Harpo thing in Chicago. And I remember just now, I mean, I think I've told you this before, I remember once because John Guerin was the GM for the Oprah thing. And at one time, I think you came in and did a demo in our studios.
Yes, I did, because John let me do that. And I couldn't believe, of course, I could believe it. It was Oprah. But here's where SiriusXM really went off on the wrong path. They were throwing money at people like it was, they were printing it.
Yeah.
And they gave Oprah $54 million for a 3-year deal. She had never done radio.
Yeah.
So she brought all of her TV pals on, and it never really got any traction. She was only on about a half hour a week. And I walked into that studio, and it was like a very nice living room with microphones. Yeah. Of course, they paid to build that out, and that was another expense. And I said to John, she should have some radio experience people on and throw my hat in there. And he said, I'd like to, but she wants to stick with this TV thing. And you have to have, yeah, that's fine, but you have to have some people that know radio in the mix.
Gary, I was the
because it's a different animal.
Oh, it is a different animal. When I, so my deal of this is I was doing the talk show up in Michigan. I had 6-7 years under my belt, live every day, 3 to 6 and afternoon drive. And I had actually met with Oprah and a guy named Tim Bennett in 2004 before it ever happened. And I got the call a couple years later to come down. And John, who I knew slightly, said, you know, I want to have lunch with you. So I brought all my stuff and my tapes and my brag book. And how many think, you know, people, the sun shines out my ass and let's go meet this guy. And we were at lunch and he looks at it. He goes, don't even open that. I said, why not? He goes, I can't put you on the air. I said, what am I doing here? He says, well, we don't have any radio people. And I said, what? He says, well, we have a lot of producers, but we don't have anybody that's ever been on the air doing talk. And I need you to coach Dr. Oz, Gene Chatsky, Bob Green, Nate Berkus, the whole lineup. And then we'll have some of the producers work with the other hosts and things like that. And I thought, how are you going to do this? So
yeah.
He said, easy, big checks. So
yeah.
Initially, I declined, actually. I said, listen, I've worked too hard. I'm giving up a lot of work here, and I have a nice, comfortable living, and I really don't need anybody. You know, I don't need this. And he says, well, here's what we'll pay you. And I said, okay, I'll do it.
Yeah.
That was the end.
Yeah.
Of that. Yeah. Sold out. But it was, yeah. And so when I saw you that day, I don't think I ever asked John, but I thought, now that's really interesting, because one of the concepts that we had talked about 2 years before it ever started was, let's build a ladder of radio talent and then put the TV people in between them. You'll have an actual radio station. That never happened.
All the money that's been pissed away, not only on SiriusXM, but terrestrial radio in the last 10, 15 years, where they had no fucking idea what they were doing.
Right.
And now they're in a hole and they're going, what happened? Well, I can tell you what happened. A lot of bad decision making with a lot of bad people in charge. It's a simple equation.
I agree. You know, and the thing about it is that foundational things in business, especially in the media and specifically radio, if you pull any of those pieces out, you're screwed. And when I got there and I saw how much money they were paying some of our quote unquote talent, I said, we will never make it. And then I flew to New York a few times and met with, at the time, Sirius and XM were separate companies. We were XM. And I flew to New York and I met with their supposed advertising sales force. And they were all about 23, 24 years old, and they were selling the whole lineup. And I said, let me get this straight. Because at that time, Howard Stern was on Sirius. Oprah was on XM, I think. So there was this battle that went on, right? And I said, you have the woman who's got the biggest brand in the world. You don't have like 3 or 4 people dedicated just to selling this. And their sales concept was, well, we don't need it. She's just going to stand up at the end of her radio or TV show, hold up the radio and say, buy these, and we're going to sell 20 million goddamn radios. Never happened.
Right.
So anyway. But
And a couple of things you said there that I wanted to focus on. They don't pay, outside of Howard Stern and the 8-listers, they don't really pay well, do they?
You talk about XM?
SiriusXM, yeah.
Yeah, well, back in the day, it wasn't there, and it wasn't Oprah's money. It wasn't Harpo money. So we all got paid pretty good, but you can't sustain it for that. You can't be paid.
No, I'm talking about the people on SiriusXM, the music jocks and all of them right now.
No.
They're probably making 30, 35 each, right?
Probably less than 50. 50 or less, I'd say.
Yeah. Yeah, and I heard that years ago because they spent all their money on those high-ticket items, but they had to fill out those other channels, so these other people that they have probably have other jobs.
I would be surprised. I would be surprised. And they don't, interestingly enough, whether it's good or bad, I'm not sure, but when you listen to satellite now, there's no, you know, spots on commercials or during music. It's all on the other channels, right, which is really smart because I think people would really dump it. But they're constantly trying to figure out ways to jack this up. And, you know, you and I know, you can only have so much inventory. Sometimes you diversify when you diversify. And when you got 300 channels of two, and they're always adding these new channels, I'm thinking, where are you getting the money to do this stuff? It's fascinating.
Yeah.
Right, now that we beat the hell out of them, what do you want to do next?
Well, and one other thing, I saw a Huey Lewis interview by Dan Rather the other night on that Access channel.
Oh, yeah.
And get this, he said that back in the 80s when Michael Jackson did that Pepsi commercial campaign, Coca-Cola approached him and the band to do something similar and offered them a shitload of money, and Huey Lewis turned it down because it wasn't cool to do corporate back then.
Wow.
Yeah, and he said, Rather asked him if he had any regrets, and he said, I regret that. It was a huge amount of money. And I'm thinking, this whole, you know, we don't do corporate, we're not selling out. That's all bullshit.
Yeah.
If somebody hands you a big check, take it.
You mean like when I went to Harpo and I said, sure, I'll do it if you had zeros like that?
Exactly.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
And I think that's, look, at this point, and you know, you mentioned Huey Lewis. When I was at WGN, and he was doing a concert like at Horseshoe Casino, or I don't know where it was at. Oh, no, it was out in, it was Tinley Park or, you know, somewhere.
Right.
And his manager's like, hey, you know, come on afterwards. And, you know, we'll, okay, great. So we had a nice conversation on the air, got tickets, went there, great concert. And afterwards, all we did was talk about golf. It's like, it was real evident to me that as long as he's been doing this, that golf at that point was more important in his life. But when I heard when I heard what he's been going through and how this has changed probably his perception on life in general, it was pretty tough to hear that. And I think, you know, when you're in radio and you have a chance to talk with people, become friends with those of name and note that started out in one way, shape, or form as a guest maybe, and then you have a, you know, an ongoing relationship with them, it's pretty special. And one of the reasons I called you is because in a little file drawer open in the back of my head, when I heard Brian Dennehy passed away, and I thought, wait a minute, don't I remember Gary talking about Brian Dennehy and all these other things? And so that was really the gist of this. How did you guys meet?
We met, 30 years ago, where he was in that movie Silverado. Have you seen that movie?
My favorite Western.
There you go. I think it was Kevin Costner's, either was his first movie or it was his breakout role.
Yeah.
Anyway, a great movie, and he was coming into town to do a play at the Goodman Theater into Chicago, and we, my partner and I, were big fans of the movie Silverado, and I knew Bob Falls, the artistic director at the Goodman Theater. So I called him and said, is there any way you think Brian would come up as a guest on the show? And he said, sure. And he brings Brian up, and Brian walked in and he looked like he just walked off the set of Silverado. He had one of those long duster coats on and just looked cool as hell, like a modern day John Wayne. And you know this, you have this image of people, these people you admire, and then sometimes you meet them and it completely deflates the whole image because they're complete assholes or something.
Right.
That was not the case. Brian was everything I was hoping he would be and more.
Wow.
And so I would go every time he'd come to Chicago, and he did a lot of plays at the Goodman. I would have him on as he did those plays.
Yeah.
And after a while, we struck up a conversation off the air, and then we started hanging out as he was in Chicago. He had a lot of time on his hands because his family would be somewhere else. I didn't live in Chicago. And we would go out to dinner or whatever. I mean, I've got all these great stories, and I just did a blog on it. Here's one I'll share with you.
Yeah.
I have him on the air once, and after we do the interview, he said, hey, I got some tickets to the Bulls game tonight. Do you want to go? And I said, great. He said, I'll pick you up at the bottom of the John Hancock building where the studio was. And I was standing down there, and this limo pulls up, and back window rolls down. Brian sticks his head out. Hey, Gary, come on. And I jump in, and there's somebody in the back seat there with him. And he goes, Gary, this is Albert Finney, Gary Meyer. He had met Albert. I guess they were staying at the same hotel. And he invited Albert. And I'm sitting at the Bulls game watching Michael Jordan play. And I'm sitting between Albert Finney and Brian Dennehy, and I'm thinking, I'm just some schmo from the south side of Chicago. How did this happen? There have been a number of incidents like that that I can share with you. Let me just go with the Brian thing for a little longer. So a few years back, he was in again during the play, and my wife and I invited him over for dinner to the house, and it was Brian and my wife and our daughter. And our daughter was about, I don't know, mid-teens, 15, something like that. So we have a great dinner, visit for hours. And then a few months later, she goes off to camp. And they have a movie night, and they show Tommy Boy, in which Brian plays Chris Farley's father.
Yeah.
And our daughter's sitting there at this movie going, oh, my God, that guy's been at our house. And it's one of those moments, those worlds collide. This is bizarre, weird, cool. And we would visit where Brian lived when we were out of town. We'd go visit them, him and his wife. And just, he was such a great guy. Here's the other thing, John. When you're going through something like we're all going through now with this nightmare, and then something like that hits, boy, I'll tell you what, it knocks the wind out of you even more so. I wouldn't want to hear that news. That a close friend dies ever, of course, that when it happens in the middle of this, when your head's already strung out, that one, that hit me hard. Because I just talked to him a few weeks ago, and he sounded so upbeat, and the Brian that I always knew and loved, and we were talking about getting together when we were out on the East Coast, and this and that, and it was one of those great things, and I'm thinking, wow, I'm so lucky to have him as a friend. Yeah. And for our wedding, he gave my wife and I these beautiful ceramic plates that hang on our wall, and now every time I went by them anyway, I would think of him, of course, and they're hanging. I mean, it's just so many things. But that's the beauty of doing what we do. You get to meet these people that you might not ever get the chance to meet.
I was on the phone with Skilling the other day because he and I did a podcast about some climate stuff, and I remember, and the way I kind of introduced it, I remember back in the day, I was in constant rotation for a couple of years. If Williams was gone, I was in, or if the morning guy was gone, I was in. And then every now and again, you'd be gone, and I'd sit from 3 to 7. First of all,
right. That's
just a bullshit shift. All you had to do, I watched you guys come up with all these plans and ideas and stuff you're going to do. And the truth is, all you had to do is wait for the 306 marker to come up and go, hey, Chicago, what's going on? And the goddamn phone lines lit up. Not fair. Well, it's true. Not fair.
Well, I'll tell you what. Tom Skilling, another guy who I'm very, very close to, he's another salt-of-the-earth guy. Yeah. And we developed a friendship before he was on my show. We developed a friendship because we had him on one of our stage shows many years ago because we kind of made fun of him. And I think he told us the story. At the outset of that, he was kind of irritated by it, but then he became super famous because we always talked about him. And then Steve Sanders, who just retired from Channel 9, Tom told me the story. He said Steve Sanders came up to him after we had been doing that Tommy Skillethead thing for years. And Steve Sanders said, hey, you think you could get those guys to make fun of me because it made you super popular. And it was one of those things. And then I had him on my show, as you know, from 3 until about 3:30. And then we do it again at 6 to 6:30 every day. And I love those segments.
Man, I was fascinated. One of the things I asked him, and I'll tell you the back side of that story, but one of the things I said, isn't it fascinating? I mean, I grew up at a time, like you did, when there were just 4 channels on television. Weather was not a big deal. It was just
no.
And to see where it's come from and to where it's at now, I find it fascinating. He says, yeah, he was in the right place at the right time. And to this day, he walks in and everybody says, oh, it's the Tom Skilling show. He says, you know, I feel good about that. And I still think that some of the anchors and the producers are, you know, got knives in their eyes at me. But he's got this huge audience. And if anybody deserves this kind of adulation and success, he's the guy. But he was telling me.
Exactly.
He was telling me. That because I told him you and I were going to be talking. Oh, Gary, you know how he talks. Oh, Gary. Oh. he says, do you know that I went out to dinner with him and Brian Dennehy one time when Brian was doing some Enron movie? Do you remember this?
Yes. Here's the deal. I took Tom to the Goodman to see Brian.
Yeah.
And then afterwards, we went for a drink next door at Pedorino's. And we sat there for several hours. And Tom unpack the story that he witnessed, we see a certain story coming over the TV cable news, and then you hear some real details and you think, oh, we're not getting the whole story here, are we? And Brian was fascinated by that. And Brian was in an Enron movie. I'm trying to remember. Was he?
He was mentioned something about him being involved in an Enron project. And then he found out at the table that he was the brother of the guy that he was doing this, something to do with Enron is what he said. So when he found out that Tom's brother was the guy that was involved, he was like, oh, Jesus, I'm sorry. You know?
No, we sat and talked about the whole thing. And I mentioned that to Tom the other day. I texted him and said, boy, sad news about Brian. Remember that night we all went out? He said, yeah, it was a great night. And that's what I like doing. I like introducing people like a Brian or a Tom Skilling to people that I know because they're such great people. I want other people to experience what they are. And I like sharing that. And I've been lucky to have these friendships. And that's really, I think, such a huge benefit of what we do.
How do you explain, if at all possible? I mean, you started in broadcasting. You know, I mean, you've been in it for decades. Just call it what it is. You've been in it for decades. And I was always fascinated at your ability to keep kind of swimming upstream. Everybody has their droughts and everybody has to sit on the beach now and again in this business. But somehow, some way, there were these kind of ladders you were able to jump up on. And I use this term in the best of respect, Gary. It's like a chameleon. You were somehow able to not lose yourself and fit into these different formats. How do you account for that?
Well, I think if you don't grow and change and adapt to what's happening, you're going to be a one-hit wonder and living in a time that has long passed you by. And I did these changes, I did these moves, these pivots, because I had to, because I was forced to be honest with you. I had situations that were untenable, and I had to move on. And when I went to the next thing, I thought, okay, I'm not going to be Ann Gary, whatever that was, I'm going to be this in the new configuration. I had two partnerships, so I was Ann Gary. And then when those two went south, I thought, that's it. I'm going to just do this. And when I went into the next configuration, I looked at the scenery and thought, okay, this is what this radio station does. This is what I do. Here's how I'm going to marry myself to it. And I did that at WLS where they were heavy politics. I don't do politics. But we found a niche, and we filled it, and it was very successful. And then when I went to WGN, I think the initial reaction, in fact, I got a number of emails from listeners who remembered me making fun of WGN back in the day. And my real focus was not to go in there and have all this swagger like, hey, I made fun of this place, and it's still something I'm going to make fun of. I respected what it was. You have to respect what that is, and then go in and assimilate and find your footing. And that's what I did. I didn't want to blow anything up. I wanted to go in and use whatever I did to become part of the WGN legacy. And I knew it could work. And I looked at the things that were strong on WGN, and I just put them in my repertoire and did what I did, and it all worked. So there's no need to blow anything up. You can go in and assimilate. But you see these people come in and go, I'm going to do what I do, and I'm not changing for anybody, and they crash and burn. You can't go in with this attitude that I'm better than this or better than that and think you're going to win, because it comes off like that.
One of the things that was interesting to me about listening to your show, whether I was in, you know, off-site listening or waiting to go on or had just come off the air, whatever it was, either in front or behind your slot, first of all, you know, for people that don't really understand radio, which is most of the people listen to it, there are just certain markers and things that have to be working. And if they're not working, you don't work. It's just,
right,
contract or not, it doesn't happen. And that 3 to 7 slot, I always thought was the toughest. It's in the morning when people are kind of waking up and, you know, you can kind of get away with a lot of giggly stuff and let's get going. Hey, hey, hey. But by the time 3 o'clock comes, people's asses are dragging. And so when I would listen to the show, you know, I started thinking, in some respects, nobody else could really pull this off, what you're doing. I hadn't heard anybody. It's usually serious. You know, we're going to talk business and politics. And you came in with this whole other wide open kind of format. And I wasn't kidding about the phone ringing. I saw it happen. I watched it happen. And I still can't explain to this day. I would tell some of the producers, it's just not fair. You know, I don't spend a whole lot of time preparing, but this guy walks in, they got stacks of papers, you know, Leslie Kiley's getting ready to do this, and you know, Elton Jim's doing his thing, and you got all this stuff laid out, and at 3:06, without saying anything except hello Chicago or good afternoon, it was like a goddamn Christmas tree would light up. And for them, you literally, I kept thinking, he will never get to all the material he brought in the room. There's just no way.
I still, John, after all these years of doing this, I still, with my podcast, do the same preparation. I don't assume anything. I figure every day is a new day, and I have to perform to the best of my ability, and I need something in hand. That's why I do a pre-recorded opening, yep, because I know I have at least one bullet in the gun. That's a guarantee, yep, because I've recorded it. It's been produced, and I like to have that to start the show off because I know that's strong footing. I'm not going to go out there like some show host and, hey, do you want to talk about this today? And yeah, right out of the box, you're stumbling and the button is pushed and you're done. Yeah. I like to come out all guns blazing. That's why I do that opening that I've done for many years, because it has, for me, that's my go juice. And then I feed off of that.
You got more production elements in that first minute than I have in four shows.
But that's the only production I do for the podcast. That's a funny thing, yeah, because that is something I send to my producer and he gooses it up. And then it's me. And then I have to start what I do right after that and carry the rest of the show. But that's fine. That's what I do. And I enjoy doing it. And there's nothing better than to have that percussion with the listener when you've established that visit and they like it and we're all firing together. And I don't do politics. It's not because of the last 4 years. I've never done it. It's not a cop-out. You know, if you've listened, yeah, for any length of time, I never did politics. It's not my wheelhouse. I don't enjoy it. I don't think it's entertaining. And boy, am I being proven right every day because it's so divisive. Once you play your political card, you've lost half the audience. And I want as many people in the tent as I can get. I don't want to change your mind about politics. That's not what I do. Yeah. And that's why McDonald's doesn't sell hot dogs. Go ask. When you go to McDonald's, go ask for two hot dogs, a bag of potato chips, and a grape, and see what you get.
And a grape.
Yeah. They don't do that. Yeah. You don't go to McDonald's for tofu. I mean, that's not what they do. And what I like about why people like me, and because I've done it so long, here's what I get a kick out of, John. I'll get an email from a listener, and they'll go, remember when you said this, and I had forgotten about it, and it made me laugh. And I thought, I came up with that? I'll give you an example. A few months ago, listener emailed and said, you were talking after Titanic came out about how when the ship was standing straight up in the water and people were falling into the water and hitting the back blades, you said that they should have all yelled hee-haw on the way down. And I thought, I said that? Well, boy, I'm pretty happy with that. But I love when people remember, yeah, certain things that you've said for years, and that's the reward I get.
It's amazing to see how
people, how when you're on, especially the radio, it's so intimate. You know, doing live radio, the first time I went to WGN was after I was at Harpo, and I took a couple years off and came back. It was like 2013, somewhere 2014, and there was that old studio in the back, in the basement. Remember before it was all demolished, and the fishbowl was up front, but that back studio. Bobby Collins was in there, and Wally Phillips had been in there. Roy Leonard had been there. And I walked in there to do an overnight. I went from making, are you kidding me, Harpo money to, I can't remember the fella's name that was the PD, White. I can't remember his first name.
Bill White.
And he says, I know who what you've done. We got to start from the bottom again. I'm like, wait, what? So I said, sure. And I did a couple overnight shifts. But the reward for me was doing it in that back studio. And I thought, this, you can't see anybody except the producers. The only people behind the glass you could see are them, and there's these consoles. And so I did that a couple times, and then eventually was able to go up and to sit on Michigan Avenue. And you know this. There was something, man, it was just a thing. You know, you had that intimate connection on the radio, and then they had that speaker on the sidewalk.
Yeah.
You could bark at people, and it was just an incredible experience. And so there's a couple times that you and I had handed off. I don't know if that was when it was all upstairs at that point, but you did the fishbowl thing too, right?
Yeah. It was the best studio I've ever worked in. I was really sad when I had to leave that because that was half the fun of doing the show there, if not 75% of it. No other radio station had a studio at a prime location like that.
Very cool. Very cool.
Yeah.
And that connection with listeners, this is what I was going to ask. So when Stern left terrestrial to go to satellite, the big thing was, you know, he had a huge listening audience. They're all going to run over there and pay a bunch of money. I don't think that is exactly how it went. For you, how long has the podcast been now? 5-6 years you've been doing this?
It's in its fifth year.
Fifth year. So you go from WGN, which is, you know, the second largest radio market on the planet in this country, and you're running that afternoon drive slot for so long, and you're entrenched in that. How has it been for people finding you, connecting with you? I know it's different because it's not live, but how has that experience been?
It's tough because you're now in a pool of 800,000 other podcasts, whereas when you're on radio, you have maybe, let's say, two or three other competitors that are doing what you're kind of doing. And to your point a few minutes ago, John, when I was off the air, I'd listen to different shows and think, you know what? What I do, nobody's doing it like I do it. So that niche is still there if I want to go back and fill it somewhere. I'm not bragging about it. It's just I do something that I think is different than everybody else. That's why I've enjoyed this long run. You have to find a niche and fill it, and it has to be different than the 50,000 other people doing it. Right. Now, to your point about podcasting, that's the trick to pull yourself out of the pack, and you're a one-man band for the most part. You don't have the marketing tools and everything else, so you've got to figure out a way to climb that ladder, and this is challenging. It's no secret. This is a lot more challenging than being on radio, but everything is migrating towards the internet. So I guess I'm right where I should be for the future because I still want to do this for a number of years. And I'll just have to figure out how to get those different levels as I go.
Yeah, it is like being in a giant sandbox, or like, you know, where did they bury the cat turds this time? Because you're sifting through stuff all the time, and some things just frankly aren't worth listening to. I mean, it's like the Jurassic Park thing, right? Just because you can make dinosaurs doesn't mean you should. And just because
yes.
Right? And just because you can do a podcast doesn't mean you should clog it up for the rest of us. But all of that aside, and you know, I have these little snapshots in my head. I was probably doing noon to three. You came in at 3 o'clock. And there was a couple times you'd walk in and you were looking. And there's things you'd say to me like, what? And it was so funny. One time, I was thinking about this the other day. I was sitting there and I hadn't shaved for a couple days. And you come walking and you don't say hi. You go, are you growing a beard or are you licking a cat? I'm like, what? And I'm like, now that's what I remember. It's something, I'm thinking he must be getting warmed up because I ain't licking a cat. It just threw me off. I'm like, okay, so whatever. Good thing I was done with doing my shift. But the thing that stands out the most of everything I've ever heard you do on the air, and the bits were great and a lot of fun, and notwithstanding all that stuff, you know, stands on its own, was that clip you would run that your dad did.
Oh.
Man. I had a hard time listening to that. And you ran that thing about Memorial Day every year. It wasn't very long, but it became this anticipated pointed listing for people. And I thought, I mean, that's the really a great use of the platform you were given to give that message.
Thank you, John. That moment when I walked into his house and he had just finished recording that is one of those moments where, even though it was 35 plus years ago now, I know every moment of it in my head. I can relive every moment of it with his little Panasonic tape recorder. It's about 13, 14 minutes long, but in the scheme of what was recorded with these World War II vets, that's a lot, because there wasn't much that these guys wanted to talk about when they came back, because it wasn't something that was embraced to talk about. Yeah. And these poor guys had to live with PTSD. Nobody knew what that was then. And just come back, had seen absolute hell, and go and start families or go to work and just pretend like it never happened. And I'm thinking, how do you do that? My father was probably 19, 20 years old. And I got that tape and he said, would you play this on the air? And I thought, wow, this is really powerful. Is it something that I'll be honest with you, I wasn't sure, because I thought this is very personal. And do I want to share it with thousands of people? And then when I talked to my partner, he listened to it and said, we got to do this. And I said, okay, we did it. And your reaction and everybody else's was pretty amazing. And now I play it probably every Memorial Day and Veterans Day. And I'll tell you what, in that 13 minutes, if you had never heard about war or seen any movies or TV shows about war, That 13 minutes encapsulates the pure evil and hell of what it is and was.
I know you don't do politics, and this isn't even a political question. I think it's more of a human behavioral question. And knowing about that clip and listening to it and what your father had to share that you shared then with millions of people over the years on radio, when you see how we are now as opposed to what he was fighting for then, how hard is that for you?
Well, and maybe you have to pull something out of this pandemic, because if we go through this and we walk out the other end and go right back to all the bullshit, then, of course, this is a complete waste of time, jobs, and everything else. I think the pandemic and everything else, especially this moment, will enlighten us to what's important and what you value and you realize. And I thought this, John, in the first few weeks when this started, here we are, we're all doing what we do, people working hard, planning, raising families, and in an instant, it can all be pulled from you. And it's something that we don't think about, because you don't want to think about that all the time, but now that we have to think about it, if we don't have some enrichment out of this to realize we're just hanging by a string. And I just don't get people that are still jockeying for stuff that matters not at all right now, and they're still doing it. And I'm thinking, are they living on another planet? Because all hell is breaking loose. People are dying. Who knows how this is going to end? And you're still worried about that? Here's the analogy I've made recently. It's like your house is on fire and you run back in and save a tub of cottage cheese. What's the point?
Yeah. You know, humans have a propensity to major and minor things. I don't know why that is. Maybe we get a heightened sense of some sort of faux purpose or something with all this stuff. But you're 100% right. Listen, you know, my daughter is on the kidney transplant list. You think I worry about that other stuff? You know, this is a life.
Yeah.
This is a thing for us every day. So I think perspective has a lot to do with it. And if it's out there, it's somebody else's problem. And when it's my problem, then it's really a problem. And if the cottage cheese is all you got to worry about, you're having a blessed day. But most of us, right? So
it's just the minutia people focus on and then let go. Even when we're given a lesson like this, which is, this is the ultimate lesson. We've never had anything like this. And we don't know what the other side's going to look like. We think we do, but we don't. We have no idea. I can't think 2 days in advance, let alone 2 months or a year. I can't. I try, but my brain shuts down because it won't go there. There's nothing I can comprehend right now. We just have to wait it out and do what's best, I guess, for everybody, which is staying home. But then is there that moment, that tipping point, where it's a game of chicken between the pandemic and the economy, and how does that work? Who wins?
If there ever was a time that you could realize as a human being you're not the most important species on the planet, that would be right about now. You know,
yes.
I mean, nature is reclaiming itself. The skies are clearer. The water's cleaner. And we are inconsequential to everything else that's going on. And even with all that's been removed, I find it fascinating. You know, the sports and all the events and things. With all that removed, we're kind of being shown who we are and who we're not. And that's what makes the headlines, unfortunately.
You are hearing these incredible stories of people doing unbelievably great things to help each other. And you think, great, okay, it's not all crap. It's not all bad. There is that out there. We don't focus on that because people, I guess, don't like to hear good news, as we've been told. But we do, and we're hearing it sometimes every day, and that's good. And you don't have anything else. You're right. I don't know what people are thinking. If the Earth wants to shut us down, we're done.
Pretty much.
This is like a hurricane that's lasting at least 2 months, maybe three, a hurricane that just keeps going. But you can see a hurricane. You can't see this. In fact, I'm noticing more and more, and I focused on this on my show, the COVID spore, which they show all the time on the news. I don't know why. At first, when I saw it, I thought, it looks like that ball they drop in Times Square on New Year's Eve. And now I look at it, and it looks like a flower bouquet. Because they're putting those red things coming out of it. It looks like a flower bouquet. And it's taking on all kinds of weird images as I look at it and think, quit showing that. It's not like you can see it and go, oh, there it comes. Get out of the way.
Right.
So I don't know why they show the spore. It's the weirdest damn thing, but they keep showing it.
This is the thing that I find, like, when you really pull back the covers and you lift up the lid on a lot of stuff. And especially with the media, you know, we've both been behind the scenes on radio for a very long time. And I think on some level, listeners would be like, couldn't believe that a lot of what happens. It's a shitty business sometimes. And every now and again, somebody really shines through and you can make a difference in people's lives like you do with your podcast, like you did on WGN and all the other places you've been at. And I think, but behind the scenes, in order to pull that off, there's a lot of moving parts and all the pieces that make that work or not. And so when I sit and watch the news, I don't listen. I mean, rarely. 15 minutes, what's the point of watching network news? It's an infomercial for drugs that are going to give me side effects and kill me. Why would I watch it?
Right.
So there's that part. But even radio, you know, I can't listen. I listen to the music channels on satellite. That's about it. I can't listen to mindless debate over majoring and minor things. And I say this across the board, whether it's my show or talks I give. I've never been to a cemetery and seen Democrat or Republican on a goddamn headstone, ever. Right? So that's not going to be carved in stone. What are you spending time on today when you don't even know you're going to be here tomorrow? But in all of this, you know, this is a side of you that I've heard come out in different ways. This is obviously a much more free form than we could ever do on GN or anywhere else. Is there a big aha for you after all this time? I ask everybody this when I have a conversation with them. When you look at your career arc, and everybody has a pivot point somewhere where you could have let it go or picked it up again or whatever. Is there any big ahas that jump out for you from all these years of doing what you do and being in people's lives the way you are?
I think because I'm still doing it, every moment seems to have a minor or major aha, and I'll probably do that major aha when it's all over, because I don't want to do it. In my mind, I think if I do it, that means it's over, and in my mind, it's not over, and I'm very reluctant to even say that aha in my head. I still like doing it. I hope people still like hearing what I do, and that's just my focus. I remember when I interviewed Howard Stern, and I said to him, did you have a moment, like I've had moments, because I know Howard's a big Beatles fan, when Paul McCartney was sitting 10 feet away from you and you interviewed him, and did you have one of those moments where you had an out-of-body kind of, I can't believe this is happening, and he said, yes. You realize, oh my God, these are moments that I could never imagine happening when I was a kid. You're watching the Beatles on Ed Sullivan, and then I have met Paul McCartney a number of times, had him on the show, and you're thinking, how did this happen? This is pretty cool. Or if you remember the Monkees, sure. I became friends with Davy Jones. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those things. I saw the Monkees TV show when I was a kid, and now I'm sitting here, and we're talking like friends, and it's weird.
Yeah.
It's weird and cool and all that other stuff that you can imagine, because you never, I don't, maybe people do, and it's not that star-gazing, oh my God, it's not that, it's something else. It's like, I get to do something that I absolutely love, and I get to meet interesting people, and that includes listeners. My current blog, depending on when you air this, I've just written a blog about this, paying homage to Brian Dennehy and to the listeners, because I have met a number of listeners over the years, and we've become real good friends. Here's an example. I was heading out of Midway once, and I apparently was talking about it on the show, and this guy called and he said, hey, I'm a TSA agent at Midway. What time is your flight? I'd like to say hello. I said, oh, I'm going out at this time. And so we get into the security line, and he sees me, he introduces himself, and he gives me a $25 Starbucks gift card. And I thought, wow, that's cool. I mean, you didn't have to do that. He goes, oh, I wanted to do that. I really liked the show. And we started talking for the few seconds we had there. And I said, give me your phone number. And he gave me his phone number because he lives in a town that I lived in. So we had a lot of commonality there. So I called him and we struck up. We have a really strong friendship now. Yeah. And that's the kind of stuff. I love that kind of stuff. It's not all celebrities. I like meeting listeners, and there's a moment that clicks, and then we become friends. And one of the funny moments, Roberto is his name, and he adopted one of the TSA dogs that retired. He came over. I was at my mother's house because my mother lives close to where Roberto lives. And he brought Bart, his dog. He takes Bart out of his car and brings him in the house. Bart bolts up to the bedrooms and starts sniffing under all the beds. And then when we brought him outside, he started sniffing all the wheel wells of the car, because that's what he's trained to do. And It was hysterical to watch. And I said to my mother when it was done, well, you don't have any drugs here or explosives, so that's good. That's one of those moments. But Roberta and I are very, very good friends. And again, it's one of those things we just met going through Midway.
And you said George, our common friend George, who handles all your technical stuff. I've known him for years. He calls me yesterday. We're getting all this. He's like, yeah, Gary called me. I'm like, oh, yeah, you know him too. So it's amazing, even though we're behind the mic for a certain amount of time, the connection you do have with people, obviously in front of the microphone. Without listeners, we're just sitting in the corner, you know, come on, right? So that's how it works. But last thing I want to ask you, because I found this part of my path. I started in 1997. I had never done radio in my life. A lot of weird circumstances put me in the studio. And I was in a little CBS affiliate in Upper Michigan. They had almost no equipment. I would interview a guest. I had five shows, actually, to get it right. And the first four shows were horrible. And the fifth one kicked in. I got five more. And I went like this for a year. Made no money, just learning what I'm supposed to do. But they had a telephone, but there was no way to run it through the board. So if I wanted to talk to a caller or a guest, I had to hold the phone up to the microphone and turn it up real loud, and then hopefully people could hear it. And it was this step-by-step process. I went from there to a bigger station, then to another station, then here, and then eventually to Oprah Radio, then to WGN, and did CBS, did all this stuff. And I know you've had a climb. You started out at the bottom rung and started working your way up. I don't know if those days even exist anymore because of technology. There's some value, I think, in even what we're doing now, which is podcasting, because you go back, you know, as I said to you earlier, the average podcast series is six episodes long. People give up. In our position and in this business, if you give up, you're gone. So that climb has a lot of value. Is that still what keeps you jumping in the seat today?
You said it right, exactly. There aren't the same steps that we took. And part of that is a lot of people don't want to get into the business anymore because it's changed so dramatically and mostly not for the good. That it doesn't pay well, and people don't want to put up with this nonsense, and three companies own most of the radio stations, so they choke the life out of everything. And people hear these stories, and they go, I'm not, won't even bother. And that is proven by the fact that a lot of people that are on the air have been on the air for many, many years because there's no new talent coming up. Right. I keep asking this question, where are you going to go if somebody on your staff drops dead tomorrow who's on the air? Who do you go to? None of these stations have a bench for the most part. They don't think anybody's going to die. And here's a good example. Remember Don and Rama on WLS? They had been on 25, 30 years, and they were doing even better every year. They're usually after a while, there's a little erosion, people move on. They were getting stronger.
Yeah.
And then Don gets sick and dies, and that was the end of that. And WLS took a huge hit and listeners because they couldn't find a replacement. They weren't even thinking replacement because nobody thinks anybody's going to die in this business.
They never recovered from that. LS, in my opinion, never recovered from that.
No.
Never.
No, they didn't. And these stations are all, I guess, trained or whatever they do to pretend that nobody will die and they don't have to replace anybody. But get ready because people die and sometimes they die suddenly and this and that. There's no one out there that they have looked at to say, okay, this is the guy we bring in, or they'll move somebody within, but then they still have a space.
Right.
That's interesting to me that you don't think about replacement. You just assume everybody's going to stay healthy and nothing will ever happen, no accidents, and we'll keep the staff for the next 25 years. Okay, good luck with that.
Bob Collins dies in a plane crash. Everybody moves up.
Right. Here's the weird thing, John. If that doesn't happen, I probably don't end up at WGN, and I'll tell you why. They moved Spike Odell into mornings, and then Spike had 1 year to go on his contract. It was an optional year where they both had to agree. He decided to decline that year. He wanted to retire. If he didn't exercise that, there would not have been an opening at that point. Hmm. Because they moved whoever the afternoon guy was up into the mornings, and then that slot opened up. And this is how a chain reaction happens. Even though when Collins died, I was firmly implanted at WLS and doing extremely well, never even thought about WGN.
Sure.
But that was a stick pin moment, and this is how life chain reacts, where it's not relevant at that exact moment, but down the road, it was.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can see the ramifications of this, and I don't want to beat the business end of it too much into the ground, but after you've seen it enough, I just keep shaking my head, because if there was one, like radio is the ultimate recycling bin. I find these guys come around more after getting fired, drugs, alcohol, you name it, and they keep getting hired at this, and I'm like, how is that possible? Which leaves no room for new talent, number one. And number two, their pattern is already set. You can already tell in 18 months they're going to be fired again. And it's just this constant incestuous relationship with the business, which I find debilitating, fascinating, and kind of revolting at the same time, you know?
Well, you sum that up right. They're hiring people that have not had a successful track record for years. And they're hiring them on a legacy?
Yeah.
And how does that work? And then they come in, and you're right, they suck the oxygen out of the room. They'll sit there, they'll sign a 2-3 year deal, take all the money, and run the thing into the ground and walk away from the carnage. And then the radio station has to rebuild. And usually they're so deep in a hole, they never get out of it. And they keep going back to that wall. And I don't get it either. And that's why the business has suffered over the years, because they kept making these bad decisions. And you can't keep making them and survive. There's no way anymore. And now, with what's going on now, what happens when we get through this? The carnage that we're going to see. Some of these companies are going to have to sell radio stations because they're going to need ready cash. This is going to be different in about 3 to 6 months or a year.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. Last question, and this isn't really a Q&A with you, but the thing that's been in the back of my head is you've had the front-end career, which was very high profile in Chicago, and you did very well with that and all those kind of things that go along with it. Slid into the podcast thing. You're learning your craft and still showing up every day with your, you know, your lunchbox and taking swings at the plate. Is there anything that would ever bring you back to terrestrial radio? Would that ever happen? Is there a scenario you could see that ever coming about, or are you firmly ensconced?
I have never said, and I know there are people out there that went, I'm never going back to terrestrial radio. And then a year or two later, they're on terrestrial radio. I learned long ago, John, never say never, although there are some nevers on my list, and I'll probably stay to that. I have never said I would never go back to radio. I never said that, and I find now that I'm doing the podcast that a hybrid would probably be the most ideal situation, do a radio show and keep the podcast, and that's kind of on my list of what I want to do. I would welcome that and have kind of been looking around to make that happen. So it's a definite possibility.
Good, good. I remember Roy Leonard, this was one of my little aha moments when I was probably a year and a half into the whole thing. And by that point, some of these names are slipping. The guy that was our GM, Tom, he was a big Hawks fan.
Tom Langmeyer.
There you go. And I hope he's not listening. Otherwise, I'll have to pretend I said his last name. But he's a great guy. We had some great conversations. And he pulls me aside one day and he goes, how do you know Roy Leonard? I said, I don't, from radio, I've never met the man. He goes, well, he's like your agent. I said, what? So apparently, whatever I was doing was catching on. I don't do a lot of the politics and stuff too. And I was just being the Northwest Side guy that I am and talking, and people enjoyed it. And he says, Roy Leonard's calling here like 2 or 3 times a week saying, you need to hire this kid. You need to give him a 5-year contract. Well, at the time, the guy they had in the mornings was from out of town. He had a long contract, big bucks. I'd sit in and whatever. And I really found, I mean, it wasn't like getting a big check, but to have Roy Leonard call on my, and I didn't know the guy, was a big deal. So I finally met him at the Museum of Broadcast Communications not long before he passed away. And I came up and I said, Mr. Leonard, I don't even know how to thank you. And he said, listen, kid, here's the only advice you need to know. Never say never in this business, number one, and hang around the edges because you might get pulled back in at the least time you expect it. I never forgot that. Yeah, I never forgot that.
Yeah, it's true. You don't know. Nobody, here, we're living this. 2-3 months ago, if somebody said to you, John, you know, in a few weeks, the whole planet will be mostly shut down. You won't, for the most part, be able to leave your house, and you won't be able to find toilet paper. You'd look at them like they're a mental patient.
That's true.
And here we are.
And here we are. Last thing, this is what I was cracking up. I was looking at the recent episodes, and the one you have here I was listening to earlier, every day seems like an acid trip.
Yeah. I've never done acid, but from what I've heard tell, this must be what it's like. it's an acid trip on steroids. I I, like everybody else, you are walking around thinking, no, this is a dream.
Yeah.
And I'm going to wake up and go, wow, thank God that never happened.
Life is nothing but a parody, isn't it?
Oh, my God. You got that right. Hey, is it cocktail time yet?
It is. It is cocktail time. I'm actually going to have a wild turkey straight up with little ice over it. You?
That sounds good. I might go Manhattan.
I hear you. Listen, man, it's been great catching up with you. I'm insisting that people, when they're done listening to this, they go listen to your stuff at GaryMeier.com, GarryMeier. You're not related, like, to the Meyer stores, are you? Is that spelled different?
No, that's got a J in it. I wish I was.
I was saying, maybe you could wrangle your birth certificate somehow and cash in, man.
Right, I'll pencil that in and try to get some of the inheritance.
There you go. Well, MG, it was great to catch up with you, and I look forward to talking to you again, man. I appreciate it.
Thank you, John. Really appreciate it. Good luck with your daughter.
Hey, thanks, man. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, keep in touch.
Sometimes when I put these episodes together, I think, who's going to want to listen to fill in the blank? You know, if I'm having a conversation with Jerry Kramer, it's really not about football, but it applies to a lot of people, and I wonder if they skip that because they're not a football person or don't even know who Kramer is. If you're not into conservation and other things like that, and you see a podcast, the conversation I had with Dr. Jane Goodall, you know, you just skip that. So what I hope people get from today is that it wasn't just a couple of radio guys batting the fat and figuring things out and beating down the business, that there are some things in there that may have value to you. And the thing that I think my biggest takeaway in the conversation with the G-Man is the constant need for not reinvention, but reinvigoration into whatever that you're doing. Radio is a tough business, and you got to be tough to be in the radio business, bottom line. It comes second nature to me in some ways to get on a microphone and talk or get on stage and talk. I've done a couple of TED Talks, more, you know, events than I could possibly count all over the world. For a time, I was huge in Trinidad, go figure. But to get on the radio every day, or even doing a podcast and put your opinions, your thoughts, your words, conversations out to the world where most people don't do that, that brings with it a special sense of responsibility. And the one thing I've always enjoyed about Gary is though he takes a lot of things serious, he doesn't take himself real serious. And I think that's part of the magic of what he does. So wish him all the well. There are some drum beats that he may be heading back, as you heard earlier, to terrestrial radio. And I think that would be good for anybody who's listening. And I appreciate you listening. Until next time, safe travels, be well, adios.